Hello, everyone. This is Chantal Cecile Cura, and I am moderating today for MomsFightingAutism.com and AutismCollege.com. And so we're continuing our conference today with its emphasis on transition to adulthood for individuals with autism. And the topic at hand right now is autism, independence, and the law. And I'm really happy to announce that our speaker today on this topic is Nathan DeCorpo. And Nathan DeCorpo is special counsel to the law offices of Elliot S. Schlissel. Mr. DeCorpo is a graduate of Pennsylvania State University, where he received his BA, and Hofstra University School of Law, where he received his Juris Doctorate. Mr. DeCorpo is a practicing attorney in the state of New York with offices in the metropolitan area. He is also a member of the National Association of Elder Law Attorneys, as well as a committee member of the Trust and Estates sections of the Queens and Nassau County Bar Associations. Mr. DeCorpo is a frequent speaker on issues of asset preservation, and he works directly with an organization called the Quality Services for the Autism Community. Welcome, Nathan.
Hi, thank you, Chantal. I'm very excited to be able to speak today. Can you hear me okay?
Nathan, you're going to be covering the basics of special needs in regards to finances, marriage, credit cards, and other financial and residential issues for adults on the spectrum, right?
That's correct. We'll go over those topics. Just first like to preface this by saying that everything we speak about today should just be considered as educational and not as actual legal advice. With that being said, I'd like to jump right into it. I'd like to first start with the marriage and relationships. The right of the autistic and otherwise mentally disabled to marry has long been a hotly debated issue. On the one hand, restricting or regulating marriage and relationships that serves to deny basic right to happiness. And that can never be the goal of society. But on the other hand, there are potential risks to parties involved, as well as the possibilities of caretaking for offspring. And that's what makes some people wary of sanctioning or encouraging these types of unions. So let's take a look at the risks inherent in being in a relationship, especially for those people that are on the autism spectrum. The big issue really is a divorce or breakup where there are children involved. Many people on the spectrum end up getting married or being in a long-term relationship that do result in children. Unfortunately, sometimes those relationships end, and just like any other divorce or breakup, the parties are going to have to make custody and visitation arrangements. Now, the courts, when determining the placement of custody of a child, are almost universally going to apply some permutation of what's called the best interest standard. This standard basically allows the court to make a determination as to custody or visitation by answering the question, what's in the child's best interest? The standard, though, it's of course a moving target because the best interest of a child is subject to change over time. It's also very broadly interpreted in different jurisdictions. But what you are going to see almost universally is the court taking a very cautious and conservative approach when there's a party seeking custody or visitation that suffers from some type of mental disability, including autism. Now, this is not to say that a person that happens to be on the autism spectrum is in any way incapable of being the residential custodial parent or able to exercise liberal unsupervised visitation. But the courts are going to be very cautious, and they're going to want to keep a tight hold on these types of cases. In a hotly contested custody matter, you really have to be prepared for your adversary to make an issue out of any mental disability, even though, the autistic parent may be completely able to care for the subject child. What this often means is that the court's going to, or at least initially, may impose maybe supervised visitation on the autistic parents, may require that the autistic parent take certain parenting classes geared towards people with disabilities. They may order forensic psychiatric reports to be conducted prior to allowing any type of visitation. These requirements, they can be quite costly, time-consuming, and they're certainly very stressful in an already very stress-filled period of transition. And it's because of these factors that whenever a parent with autism finds themselves in this type of situation, they really need to reach out early and seek out counsel in their jurisdiction, because they're going to have a lot of obstacles in their path to custody or visitation. It's not an even playing field, so to speak. So that's one of the major considerations we need to look at when looking at marriage and relationships. The second, of course, and I'm sure we've heard a little bit about it today, would just be the marital finances when contemplating a marriage. I could probably spend the rest of the afternoon telling you about the financial repercussions of a divorce, but I'm just going to hit a few points for us today. As you're aware, the finances of an adult with autism have to be carefully planned as to maximize their ability to obtain and retain government benefits. When a divorce occurs, there could be a windfall or a new liability, which was not considered when setting up the financial plan of the autistic adult. I'll give you for an example a scenario where an autistic adult receives an equitable distribution award of cash or real property. The parties, while they were married, they may have carefully titled the assets to make sure that the autistic party was able to maximize his resources, but now some asset is going to go into the autistic party's name, and that's going to affect their eligibility in certain programs. The answer to this question could be as simple as diverting the asset to a trust, but not always. I'll give you another example. I happen to represent a client who was low on the spectrum. He was getting a divorce. He happened to own a co-op in Manhattan, and we ended up settling the case with my client ending up with the co-op as part of his equitable distribution award. It was set up nicely for him, and he was very comfortable, so it was very important that he retain this apartment. The problem was that after the divorce, my client was no longer going to be receiving health insurance through his spouse. He would now be receiving Medicaid. It was determined previously that the co-op should be held in a trust that had been previously set up for him, a supplemental needs trust. However, this particular co-op had on it a restriction of owner occupancy. That's a common thing. Sometimes the asset itself is restricted from being placed into the trust. The trust would then actually become the owner, and my client being the beneficiary of the trust. And so there was a proscription on him putting that asset into the trust. That's just one of the ways to illustrate how these divorce finances complicate an already difficult situation. Another point on finances is when there's a child born to the marriage. Following the divorce, the non-custodial parents, he or she will be obligated to pay support to the custodial parent, even if they suffer from a disability. Now, there are certain checks in place, like there's a self-support reserve that limits or attempts to prevent child support obligations forcing someone below the poverty line. But these aren't always successful, and so it should be noted at this point that you have to be very careful in how much income you have. It should also be noted that the courts are able to invade a trust for the benefit of the individual with the support obligation to capture any arrears payments, whereas the trust would previously not have been accessible to a creditor. In a situation where there is a child support obligation, the courts have and do frequently invade otherwise irrevocable trusts. Now, a final consideration you're going to want to look into is the assumption of debt. When parties get married, they commingle their assets. They also commingle their debt. So if a party gets married and later divorced, the previously non-debtor spouse may now be on the hook for some or all of their spouse's debt. This has the effect of throwing off any potential financial plans. Now they've assumed this this huge liability as a result of the divorce. The good news being that typically this type of debt wouldn't be able to invade the corpus of a trust. We'd like to move on to what's called incompetency. Now, you have to be competent at the outset to actually enter into the bonds of matrimony. And so incompetency is a term of art used in the legal profession. And so when I say incompetent, I'm usually talking about an adjudication by the courts to that status. So being mentally incompetent deals with the ability to perform a duty or understand the consequences of one's actions. It's broadly defined state by state, but typically defined by one's inability to know or understand what they're doing or the resulting consequences therefrom. And most states' common law on contracts will say that if the nature, purpose, and consequence of the contract are not fully understood due to the lack of mental capacity, the contract is avoidable. So what that has the effect on a marriage is, if they were judged later to be incompetent, they could then attempt to annul the marriage. That is not the opposite, but one of the alternatives to a divorce. It differs in that it's as though the marriage never occurred. It has been annulled from the outset. Now, incompetency also plays a huge role in contract law and in the ability of the autistic adult to enter into contracts. You'll often see, I'll take this a step back. I think someone had previously spoke on the appointment of a guardianship and how a person is adjudicated to be incompetent. So you have some basis there. But if a person is adjudicated as incompetent, then they are per se unable to enter into a contract as a party having capacity to do that. Now, this doesn't mean it never happens. Any contract that the person adjudged incompetent entered into would be considered void ab initio, void at the outset. This would have the effect of canceling any debt that the incompetent person owed pursuant to the contract, or release them from specific performance or an obligation to do something pursuant to the terms of that contract. This is a very important concept in American jurisprudence. Many people with disabilities are often preyed upon, conned into bad deals all the time. This is usually where the role of the guardian is going to kick in to protect the AIP or the incompetent person.
Nathan?
Yes.
Nathan, can I ask a question? Because no one actually has yet at this conference brought up conservatorship. So did you want to explain that on a general level about that? Because I think we're kind of putting the cart
horse
before
the carriage. Sure. Absolutely.
I know it's different state to state, but on a national level,
Sure.
Yeah, thank you. If you could just bring up a little bit about that, that would be wonderful.
No problem. Basically, a conservatorship or guardianship is a proceeding handled in typically the Supreme Court or the surrogate's court in your state jurisdiction, where a person is adjudged to be incompetent or competent, depending on the facts before the court. They are entitled as what's called an alleged incompetent person or incapacitated person to notice of this hearing. They have the right to retain counsel of their own. If not, just like in a criminal matter, counsel will be afforded to them at no cost, or eventually the cost will be borne by his estate. Typically, the courts will look at whether or not there's proof that they can understand the decisions that they've made, if they're able to care for their person and property. But it really does differ state by state. Now, it should be noted that a guardianship proceeding or a conservatorship proceeding can be brought by third parties, not just somebody related to the AIP. It could be a creditor It could be a landlord. It could be many different people that want something from, you know, something to happen that the incapacitated or incompetent person is not doing, such as paying rent or paying their debt. And that's why the court may or may not appoint a person, a conservator or a guardian over the person or property. So, you know, that's the distinction. They can, if a conservator is placed over the person, that gives that guardian the right to direct medical attention, direct residential housing where they're going to live, or if it's just over the property, the guardian then takes care of the person's bank accounts, you know, that kind of idea. Similar to a power of attorney, but in this situation, fully recognized by the courts and determined by the courts. That being said, you understand a little bit about how a guardianship works. Any contract that the person enters into that has been already adjudged incompetent, that would be considered void. Now, what that doesn't mean, though, is that they can't actually enter into voluntarily a contract. It just means that the enforceability of that contract is, you know, very difficult for the party adverse to the AIP. Now, the issue is trying to set aside these bad contracts or bad debts. That's a costly and litigious process. And because this happens, many people set up spendthrift trusts. That would allow the beneficiary access to, you know, a certain amount of money through either a credit card or a debit card, and they can't further encumber it. So that's really why we set up a lot of spendthrift trusts. Now, in adjudication of incompetency, though, that does not totally absolve a person from liability. What it does is it has the effect of changing the negligence analysis to some extent. So what I'm talking about here is the person has been adjudged incompetent. They have gotten themselves into an accident where it was their fault, or most likely their fault. They could still be on the hook. So the analysis differs state by state, but typically it revolves around whether the person knew or should have known that they owed some duty of care to someone that they injured. So now that the person is adjudged to be incompetent, it makes it much more difficult for the plaintiff, now the person suing you, to prove that they knew or should have known that they were supposed to do something. They've already been adjudged to be incompetent. But courts do, you know, sometimes still find people that are adjudged incompetent to have been negligent, and people go after them, plaintiffs go after them. Similarly, an adjudication of incompetency doesn't prevent you from getting arrested or in, you know, negative interaction with law enforcement. In fact, this is a real issue in a lot of states, and I've had many clients actually that do suffer from some form of disability, not necessarily autism, but I have had some low-spectrum autistic clients that found themselves arrested. This usually happens, during some particularly stressful period, you know, in the now defendant's life. And there's usually some breakdown in communication or misunderstanding between the autistic or disabled individual and the police. Unfortunately, it's difficult for the police officer to rapidly ascertain a person's mental status in the heat of the moment. And, you know, that's why we often see the resulting arrest. There are some states, actually, that considering legislation that would require or allow an autistic adult to have identification that puts a label on them for this purpose of quickly ascertaining what's going on. Now, there's arguments for and against this, but it's just good to know, that that's out there, and you may see more of it to come. Doesn't matter where you live when you're getting arrested and being processed, it will be a very scary and stress-filled experience. This is especially the case if you happen to suffer from a mental disability or autism. Your experience is going to be unfamiliar, uncomfortable, confusing, and exhausting. Luckily, what you have in most jurisdictions, New York especially, this is where I practice, is some type of diversionary court, a mental health court that enables the criminal justice system to screen out defendants with mental disabilities and deal with them in a more appropriate manner, to subject somebody to the whole trial by their peers. It's very difficult when they suffer from a disability. It's difficult for them to get a fair trial. And people, often use this insanity defense. It's not exactly accurate. Really, what's happening when someone pleads insanity? They don't really plead insanity. It's typically not guilty by reason of mental disease or defect. And what you're really doing is you're not telling the court you're insane. You're saying that at the moment of the alleged crime, you were unable to know the nature and consequences of your actions. Now, when a person does this, okay, and the court accepts the plea, they say, okay, you in fact were unable to understand what was going on at the moment. Usually, this does not mean that they go free. Quite the contrary. They usually find themselves now subject to a subsystem of the courts, which would then determine their placement in some type of facility or, depending on what's available in the jurisdiction. But it's often for a period of indeterminate time. And, once you're in this subsystem, it can be very difficult to, navigate yourself out. Again, that's why it's very important to, retain counsel early on that is, especially experienced in your particular jurisdiction, how to avail yourself of these services and also how to get yourself out. Another major issue the transitioning adult is going to face, the transitioning autistic adult is going to face, is housing. Now, I'm going to speak mostly about a person on the lower end of the spectrum, and as they look for private housing, I won't go into specific services just because they're so localized, wouldn't really be of much use. But at the state and federal legislation exists, which prohibits discrimination of renting or selling housing on the basis of a person being part of a protected class. And for our purposes, autism is recognized as a disability and therefore covered as a protected class. So what kind of housing is considered for protection? What you're going to be looking at is any apartment building, a multifamily dwelling, a co-op, condo, any government-assisted housing. You've got the residential hotel kind of long-term hotels. That's what's covered under state and federal legislation that prohibits discrimination. You're not covered if you're a resident in it's a two-family home, but the owner is also a resident. That's not covered. If you reside in a home and you're renting a room, that is not, and it's not a government-assisted housing, that is not covered. Now, it does become covered if the accommodation gets advertised. So that's just something to look at. Most housing gets advertised, even on Craigslist.
Oh, I'm sorry. You mean if is this a national thing or a local thing? Do you know?
Well, this is a local thing. Greater New York area. I do apologize
for
that.
Okay, so in other words, if someone knows of a place to live but they don't advertise it, but you find out about it through a friend or something, they're allowed to not rent it because it isn't
correct.
Area to ask who would like to live here or who has the money to live here. But once it's out there, like on a Craigslist or a newspaper advertisement or through a realtor, you can't discriminate. Is that what you're saying?
That is correct.
Okay.
All right. What kind of things can they do? Landlords or realtors, the biggest thing, obviously, refusing to sell or rent or lease housing. And what this means is they cannot not rent to you on the basis of a disability, your disability, being autistic. It's not that is illegal and discriminatory. You can't do it. You have remedy under both federal and state law. And it could require that if you really want, that they allow you to rent the premises. They also cannot misrepresent the availability. So you can't put an ad out. Say you've got an apartment. Then, when an individual comes in, an autistic individual comes in and says, I'd like to rent it, or his family says he'd like to rent it, and then tell him it's not for rent. If it's for rent, it's for rent. If it's for sale, the same thing. You can't, you cannot misrepresent that. And again, if you do, you're subject to fines. You're subject to being forced to either rent or sell the property. It's specifically proscribed by law. Further, you can't set different terms or conditions. You can't raise the rent for a person with autism. You can't, change the lease terms. You can't say, oh, it's only a six-month lease now. The terms are the terms. They have to be the same for everybody. You can't have different facilities, obviously, for, disabled people or autistic people. It has to be the same. It's one type of apartment. Everyone gets that. You can't have the disabled apartment, unless, of course, you've done it to accommodate, and I'll get to that in a minute. You cannot.
I just wanted to let people know that are writing in questions that we're going to be answering the questions later. So do write in those questions, and we will be addressing those later. Thank you very much.
Okay. You're further prohibited from posting any type of discriminatory advertising. You can't say no disabled people, no children, married couples only. Can't do that. Specifically proscribed by law from doing that. Now, the big one is refusing to provide what's called reasonable accommodations. This is pursuant to the American Disabilities Act for a person with a disability. The law requires that a landlord pay for an accommodation if it's deemed to be reasonable. Now, reasonable, that's typically interpreted as meaning both architecturally and financially feasible. Here you see this a lot in the housing courts. A landlord doesn't want to put up a ramp or doesn't want to open a wall, and they dispute. They bring in their own architects and say, you can't do it. And, that becomes a whole court case in its own. But the law does require that if it is reasonable, they make accommodation for any person with disabilities. Let's see what else we're doing. There's also a proscription on lending practices. A person with a disability is just as able to obtain credit or a mortgage as anybody else. So there's a proscription on refusing to make a mortgage to a otherwise qualified applicant if they happen to be a member of a protected class. You have to provide the information regarding the loans. You cannot impose different terms. It's the same idea, but just to reiterate, a person with autism has the same right to obtain a mortgage, to obtain a line of credit, as anybody else. And if you find yourself in a situation where you believe you're discriminated against, you have several remedies under the law, under Fair Creditor Act, under Discriminatory Housing Act. There's several remedies of law that allow you to fully exercise your rights. That's about all I have. I'd like to open it up to questions now if we if we have some.
Yes, we do, and I have a couple already, though, since we're still on the – since you just mentioned credit cards. If
sure.
someone has okay, I don't know how it is in the state of New York. I know different states it's different, but,
mm-hmm.
for example, in California, if you have guardianship or conservatorship, there are 8 different areas. So, like, one is relationship and marriage, one is financial. You know, there are different areas, and you could possibly have guardianship or conservatorship for a couple of them, but not – conservatorship, but not for all of them. So,
that's
for
right.
example, when it comes to credit cards, if someone is conserved financially,
mm-hmm.
they wouldn't really be allowed to sign up to get credit cards. And if somebody did get them to sign up for a lot of credit cards and get a lot of debt going, would the family still be responsible, even though, you know, it's clear that this person is conserved?
Typically not, no. There wouldn't be a fiduciary obligation. If the credit card was signed by the person who was under the conservatorship, then no. And they just signed up, you know, because it will show up on a credit check.
Right.
You know, the credit card companies know if you've been adjudicated, they know everything about you.
Okay.
No, you wouldn't have that. But are they going to try and come after you? Yes, that's the problem. They're in the business of lending and making money, so they're going to come after you for it, and then you have to deal with it, and that's going to, you know, be a hardship on the conservator, and he's going to have to deal with it. But what does happen oftentimes, I do see, is that the conservator will set up a account that it can be a credit card, just through their guardianship account. Absolutely.
Sort of like the way student accounts are. Actually, well, I don't know if they are here, but my daughter went for a semester abroad college,
mm-hmm. yep.
and so she had her own account that was linked to our account, but there was only a certain amount that she could access every month, and if she ever went over that amount, she
exactly.
couldn't.
Exactly. Yeah, that,
so
that's
same
usually,
kind of account you could do here?
Exactly, and that's usually the solution that most people end up, you know, doing, because you need them to be able to have access to some, you know, the money. You don't want them to have to call you for $20. They need to be able to have quick, liquid, you know, access to money. And but
right.
you want to have that safeguard in place.
Okay, so here is a question. I'm going to start with some questions that are coming in.
Sure.
Julie McKernan from Upland. As my 15-year-old with high-functioning autism approaches adulthood, I'd like to know the options and alternatives to conservatorship.
Well, the options are you execute, you know, at 15, they're too young to execute any advanced directives. Those advanced directives being, you know, a power of attorney, a healthcare proxy. You know, that's really all you can do in terms of your alternative to a conservatorship once they turn 18. Since they're still under the age of majority, that, you know, as a parent, you still have the right to control them. But, that, you know, upon attaining the age of majority, that becomes your option, either a guardianship or conservatorship or advanced directives that clearly allow you to step into their shoes, handle their affairs when they aren't able to do it. The healthcare proxy, they can revoke the healthcare proxy, so they have quite a bit of, you know, they still have their independence. But if they become sick or unable to make the decision, you have that in place. The issue, if they're doing something that's dangerous to their health or safety, you then are able to, there's typically, in New York, we have 72-hour psych holds. You can bring that type of proceeding. They go in, they get evaluated, but they can still leave on their own. So that's kind of what you have.
Okay, here's just a comment before we go to more questions from
sure.
Michelle in Carlsbad. She asks us not to refer to autism as a mental disorder. It's a neurological disorder and not mental illness.
I do apologize for that.
So, okay, then we have Regina Del Oro in Manhattan Beach. We have a 17-year-old son with autism. He will turn 18 in July. I have looked at special needs consultants who would help with conservatorship. They charge a flat fee, which is a fraction of what a law firm would charge. They advise to wait until after my son turns 18 so as to waive the fees from the courts. In your opinion, is there a risk in doing this? In other words, in waiting until after 18 and are also using special needs consultants? Is it advisable to file this with a lawyer, or is it a fairly bureaucratic filing which can be done with a consultant?
In New York, you would need an attorney to do it. However, you can make application to have an attorney appointed. I can't speak to other states. It is, to some extent, fairly bureaucratic, but you lose control when you allow someone else to set it all up. You want to be as engaged with it as possible. That's the value add with having an attorney or even a consultant set this up for you. You want to be as involved as possible. You'll let the courts kind of do it on their own, and that, I presume, is why the consultants get involved at the age of 17 to kind of put the whole picture together before it gets presented to the court when he turns 18.
So what is the difference, waiting before they turn 18 or after they're 18?
Well, the difference is that at least not in New York, not really. I mean, you're already the guardian when they're 17. I think they're just putting it all into place beforehand and being able to just pull the trigger when they turn 18. That's what I would presume. That's
right,
the service
of
these consultants.
Right, that's what normally we kind of do here.
Right.
The waiting until after my son turns 18 so as to waive the fees from the court, I don't understand what that – do you understand what that question is?
Well, what I think she's trying to do is now basically because he's an adult, the fees fall upon him, and he's a impoverished individual. Now that he's adult, he's not required to be cared for by his parents, so they can't go after the parents' money and require them to privately pay for, you know, there's going to be, you know, a case manager. Professionals. Yeah, so that's what I presume is happening there.
But
because $10,000 is what you're going to spend.
I would just say if you're using a special needs consultant, obviously you would want a special needs consultant, if they're not an attorney, to be very well versed.
Oh, absolutely. I work with a lot of financial planners that know most everything, but there are ins and outs of each court system that, you know, you have to know. So you can't always just do it without an attorney. At least call one. They'll talk to you free. Most will give you a free consultation, so I'll at least contact a few. You'll probably find a reasonably priced one out there. But speak to them. I'm sure somebody would speak to you for free.
Yeah, and the other question I had about waiting until they're 18, when you're talking about an individual who may have autism but may be very functionally able, if you will.
Sure.
There might be some, decision making on the part of the judge as to whether conservatorship is a necessity or not. Is there some problem or challenge with waiting until they're after 18? Because what if the individual thinks and convinces the judge that he's able to handle everything himself?
Absolutely. The we call it an AIP, the alleged incapacitated person. They have the fundamental right to be at every hearing.
They should be, definitely.
They have the right to counsel. They can present themselves, make the case. And if they're able to do it, then, and they want to contest the guardianship, the judge will oftentimes side with them. I mean, this is a fundamental restriction on liberty, a guardianship. And so the judges are very, very cautious, and they should be, absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. Here's another question from Rose Redmond in Holland, Michigan. Do you feel an individual with autism and a mild cognitive impairment is better off to have guardianship in place, or is a POA sufficient in most cases? POA, I guess, means power of attorney?
Yes. If they're an independent person and they can, your activities of daily living are, they've got that down, then I think a POA, a power of attorney, is appropriate. Here's the issue that I have with guardianships, and then the issue exists with power of attorney as well, but if you're the guardian of your adult, you know, child, and you in fact become infirm or die, you now have a problem. You have a problem because to undo a guardianship or appoint a new guardian is difficult, and your son or daughter is restricted in what they can even do. So if they're close to being able to handle their own stuff, you want to tread lightly. That would be my, you know, that would be my advice. You have to be careful. Put as few restrictions as necessary. You can always put them in if you have to. I would start first with the advanced directives, with the power of attorney, with the healthcare proxy, and you wait and see. You see how it goes.
And also, every individual, it's so individualized that it's really
absolutely
hard to explain statements.
Absolutely. And you can dissolve a guardianship. There is a proceeding to dissolve the guardianship. If at some point they don't, you know, it seems inappropriate, it can be dissolved. So, you know, you can do that. It complicates things when you're the guardian, everything goes through you, and now you're taken out of the puzzle. And everything's revolving around you. So, you know, you need to either have a co-guardian or successor guardian in place, and sometimes people don't have that. Because what will happen is the courts are going to appoint somebody as your successor guardian. You're not going to know them. They're not going to necessarily know you, but they're going to now be the ones in charge. So you really got to look at it.
Here's a question from Michelle Wolfson in California.
Mm-hmm.
Are people with disabilities protected under the ADA or another law from HOA, Homeowners Association requirements, which would prevent them from living in their own home?
From a homeowner, yeah, a Homeowners Association would not be able to, you know, prevent you from staying in your own home. I think what she means is preventing you from, you know, if there's a prescription on putting a ramp or certain things on the exterior of your house. They are typically protected. You would have to show the necessity of the whatever the offending, you know, appurtenance to the property is. But, yes, you are protected under the ADA. What you would end up doing is, you know, you're looking for a declaratory judgment from a court saying you're able to do that, and that would essentially would serve that upon your homeowner association.
Well, you would hope it wouldn't come to that. With your
you
neighbors.
Hope it doesn't come to that, but you know you don't want to erect your ramp and then they tear it down.
Like that.
Send a letter first. That's your first. That's your first step.
Here's a question from T. Cutler in Layton. If you receive state funding for respite, Medicaid, job coaching, et cetera, will you be responsible to pay back the government for those services once the disabled person, the disabled parents pass away?
Once the
or as
disabled...
long as the proper special needs trust is set up and worded correctly, then it won't be automatically needed to be paid back. I guess it's talking about when disabled, you want me to read it back again?
Well, yeah, I can speak. I think all special needs trusts are going to have a payback provision requiring, you know, payback for anything left over at the end of the disabled person's life. They can't leave a succession plan for anything remaining unless there's anything left after Medicaid gets paid back. Then they can pay. You know, they can set up a succession plan for that remaining, you know, money.
Okay.
Is that what they were asking?
Yes. Yes, I think so.
Yeah, all SNTs are going to require payback.
Another mm-hmm. If the person who asked that question is still listening and it wasn't clear, you can always send in another question. This is from TY in Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, again, I'm going to have to remind people that we can't answer personal questions, but I'm going to go ahead and read this.
Okay.
Does my child qualify for SSI, and how does she get help with applying? Because she can't get anyone to hire her, and she wants to attend college in the fall and can't provide for herself. Is there anyone who can help her to qualify because she has autism and anxiety disorder? And I think that's the kind of question you would find out from knowing other people in local autism organizations to get help on how to access services. Do you have any advice to give on that?
Well, you know, I don't want to give you a direct referral, but yes, you're going to have you know, there are disability attorneys that, you know, the SSI process is difficult. You have to fail several times before they actually grant it. You really do need a, you know, an attorney, or I know there's advocacy groups that that do it too. You're going to need help getting professional help. Don't expect to just apply on your own. You need someone that knows the system on that. There's several big ones out there. I just don't want to particularly name them.
The reason why I mention your local autism organization is that you can find out by talking to other parents or professionals there who they know.
Maybe
people's membership, who they recommend. Because you always, you know, in your area, there'll be the same names that pop up. And
yep.
So those are the ones you'll probably want to check out first. But everything does seem to get complicated, so it's good to have the right person helping you.
Oh, yes.
Okay, here's a question. If a conserved person has an auto accident or does something criminal, is the family financially responsible for any civil lawsuits that could be filed against the conserved person? That's a really good question.
Right, and I think I touched a little bit about this.
Yes.
The conservatorship doesn't totally absolve them from liability. So, yes, let's say you have a person that's only that only their property is conserved, and they get themselves into an auto accident. They're still technically liable. It's just the ability to go after the money is a little more difficult for the plaintiff. But, yes, you can find you'll see it oftentimes. Yes, you do have the liability, exposure. Even if you're the subject of a guardianship or a conservatorship. Now, the actual fiduciary, the conservator or the guardian, they don't necessarily have any liability for your actions, unless you can show their gross negligence in they gave them a car, and they certainly shouldn't be they have to prove the gross negligence or the criminal negligence on behalf of the fiduciary, then maybe you can get it, but it's typically not, the liability doesn't run to the fiduciary. If the fiduciary steals the money, then yes, that they get in big trouble, but that's a different question.
Story. Can I ask you, can you explain what is the difference between a guardian and a conservator?
It's really just typically a term of art used in different jurisdictions. Some jurisdictions may make a distinction. A guardian may refer more to the control over the person's body, essentially, the corpus, what they're able to do, where they live. And the conservator may, they may say that's more relative to his money. In New York, for example, we really just use the term guardian of either the person or property. So it's really just term of art, nothing... no real distinction between the two.
Okay. Here's a question from Vinny. Mm-hmm. Based on your experience, how do you make sure that the child has a guardian legally after the parents are no more?
Could you just repeat it one more time? I'm sorry.
Yes. Based on your experience, how do you make sure that the child has a guardian legally? You know, how do you legally make sure that there's a guardian after parents are no more?
Well, so you have a couple options. One, in your will, you can actually pre-designate. You're suggesting in your will who will become the guardian. The courts will look at that when they bring a guardianship, when the eventual guardianship proceeding comes. They're going to look at the intent of the former guardian. Who did they want to be the guardian? Some states allow you to execute a document called a pre-designation of guardian, where you're basically kind of pre-approving a guardian, and they'll give that a little bit more, they're going to look at that even more. But otherwise, those are your options. You can set up a trust that essentially has a private guardian, but it's a trustee, and that will be in place upon your death, but it's already going to be in place, and the courts won't really have any say in it. So you can do that. You'll set up a trust and appoint a trustee. So, the probate process doesn't have any effect on that. That's already set up. So that's kind of your, if you really want to make sure this one person is in charge of the money, you set up a trust in your lifetime with the trustee.
Yeah, and we'll be talking more about trust tomorrow, which is why we aren't really spending a whole lot of time on that, just for the listeners to know that they have that option for tomorrow.
Sure.
But, you know, I had a question, because you started out right away talking about marriage.
Yes.
And divorce, but I wanted to ask you something from a different perspective. I'm talking about parents who are getting divorced, you know, let's say neurotypical parents, with children with autism, because it's been my understanding, and I'm not sure how this works in other states, but typically in California, where there's usually child custody of 50-50 unless there's a real reason why not, it's been typically very difficult for parents in the state of California to prove that there's a special, that their child's special needs should be taken into account. You know, let's say, for example, if you have one parent who's, you know, very knowledgeable and very active and very much of an advocate for their child, and has learned all the special skills they need for parenting or whatever, versus another parent who might be more absent. Do you have experience with that in the New York area?
Well, we do, and the reason is there's an overarching policy consideration that the courts always want to maintain relationship. They find it to be in the best interest of the child to maintain the relationship with both parents as best you can. So to diminish the relationship, you know, even though one parent is so much better attuned at the caring for the needs of the, you know, child, it's going to, you know, they're going to be very cautious in doing that. They really want to promote
right.
the relationship, even though, you know, the parent doesn't know what to do all the time. So we see that. It seems to be that overarching policy is, you know, sometimes to the detriment of the child, just because, you know, with some of the therapies, you know, you need to have that continuity between the two parents, and you don't, and I see that all the time. That's always brought up whenever there is, you know, an autistic child in a custody dispute. Absolutely.
Right. And so I was just wondering about this because I'm not an attorney, so I'm not divorced, but, you know, I've heard stories or been actually expert witness sometimes just from the autism perspective, you know, practical.
Absolutely.
Do you ever hear about directives coming down from the judge maybe about asking a parent to have more training or to get more involved in a certain way before they allow them to have more control?
Absolutely.
You know,
oh, yes. We often, I mean, I have several doctors that, you know, I use often in custody cases, you know, that will testify as to what needs to happen. And that will be part of a comprehensive, you know, parenting kind of plan. You know, if there's certain ways, things, you know, certain therapies that need to be exercised daily. Yes, absolutely. The judge will put that in the judgment of divorce. You know, in the documents, you'll see it spelled out clearly. Absolutely.
Not that I'm pushing for divorce, but I you hear these stories and you kind of wonder, isn't there more common sense involved in here sometimes?
And what happens is, you know, a party then doesn't do it, and then they're back in court for a violation of the order, and, you know, the matter gets litigated, and eventually the child grows up. But, we see it often.
Okay, so back to more areas that we were talking about earlier. And I just want to remind people, you can type in questions into the box, or if you're online, you can do a *2. And I will see a little hand come up on my computer, and I can take your call. Okay, so here's a question from Joyce Davenport in Portland.
Mm-hmm.
Is an advanced directive a better option for an adult child with autism who is on the more able end of the spectrum, so that as the parent you have say over his care if he is not able?
Yes, that's exactly what it is. If they're not able, that's exactly what the power of attorney or the healthcare proxy is going to do. It's just going to be utilized when they're not able to make those decisions, or, you know, if they're sick. So it's kind of the least restrictive way of accomplishing that. It's a relatively simple document to get in place. It should definitely be part of, you know, part of the package.
And so the same person asks, do you suggest a consultant to help with this or an attorney?
You need to be careful. These documents do change periodically the way they're drafted. I would just be careful. You know, I know people like to use LegalZoom or some of these other products. Be careful with that. Consult an attorney. I wouldn't expect to pay more than, you know, a couple hundred bucks for these documents. So you want to have them right. For example, in New York, if you don't have this rider to the power of attorney, you're going to be restricted from any gifting, and you'll learn more about gifting when you discuss trusts. But these are real important components that's going to be outside of your general short-form power of attorney, and you may not know that unless you do have an attorney or you do have a consultant. So I would pay the extra, get it done right.
Okay. Yeah, what is, when people are asking about consultants, what do they mean by consultants anyway? Consultants help with legal issues if they're not attorneys?
We don't see them that often. They're kind of like, I guess, case managers. We don't really have that too much in New York. Similar to kind of like a financial planner, that kind of puts everybody together. Put your attorney and your accountant and your case manager, your psychologist, kind of get them all communicating. That's what I presume that everyone's talking about, or just, you know, that have some fundamental knowledge of the issue, but are not attorneys.
Do you have any experience that you could share about what is the best way to discuss some of these options with perhaps an individual who's, you know, 16, 17, 18, getting to that age where, you know, guardianship or conservatorship is something to be considered? And perhaps, there's going to be discussion about possibly doing conservatorship and going through this whole thing. How do you bring it up to someone who is could be very intensely argumentative about things, because there are some people that are that way. How do you suggest parents handle this?
Well, what I typically do, you want to, at least, you know, when I'm dealing with this kind of thing, avoid judgment calls, okay? Avoid making judgments. I put it in their hands, and you ask the question, what if, okay? What if this happens? And if the answer to that is everything falls apart, that's when you need to, the guardianship, you need the conservatorship. You know, what if I die and no one's able to watch you do, you know, and your money? You know, what if this happens? Frame it in that type of context. If they can make the connection, they'll see it, and it'll ultimately benefit them.
Yeah,
but it's very difficult. You're going to have opposition. They're going to, people are going to oppose having the guardianship. That's just kind of your visceral reaction, no matter what.
Yeah, well, it's kind of interesting because even, just neurotypical individuals sometimes at 18 are not ready to make life-changing decisions. And so it's really difficult as a parent, no matter where your child is, on or off the spectrum. Here's a really interesting question from outside the United States, actually, from St. Lucia in the Caribbean, from Vivian.
Okay.
What has been your experience in the likely outcome of applications of a parent on behalf of an adolescent or adult on the more able end of the spectrum to take away altogether her daughter's ability to procreate? Now, that's a hot topic everywhere. We were talking about marriage, we were talking about relationships, but what about taking away somebody's ability to procreate?
Yeah, that is very, very difficult. Sometimes, but it is part of a guardianship. That is part of it. You would typically need further adjudication by the court, on that specific issue. They are very reluctant to do it, but they will. If presented with medical evidence, circumstances that show the likelihood of conception and why it's going to be very detrimental, it's possible. but they're very, that's a very, you know, no judge wants to get that one. They don't want to make that determination if they don't have to, but it's unlikely, but it is possible.
Yeah, it's always difficult for those types of situations because it is, you know, the right of a person, and you're talking about human basic rights here.
Absolutely.
And so it is really difficult. When do you think is a good time for a parent to start thinking about the challenges of conservatorship and guardianship? And how, if it's before the age of 18, how much of a time before that? Even if you're working with a case manager or someone in social services who's helping you, because some states you do have that and some states you don't, how far in advance should you start thinking about this?
Well, you know, at least a year. Luckily, though, most states, most courts, it's a quick process that you're able to start a guardianship proceeding. But that doesn't mean it's going to be finalized quickly. You can usually at least get some type of immediate emergency relief in the event that you need to do that. We call that an order to show cause. That's kind of an emergency motion you're able to make to the court to say, hey, we need to get this going. We need to be able to at least step in temporarily while you determine if a guardianship is necessary. So, you know, you want to, planning is, you know, is very important, but know that you can always get that emergency order if you need to. You know, a year to 2 years beforehand, start getting things into place. You're going to have to start talking to potential successor guardians. Are they going to be you know, willing and in a position to step in if you're unable to be the guardian? So, yeah, I mean, 1 to 2 years, I would say, is appropriate.
Yeah, and are there options for people who don't have access to attorneys or who don't have the funds for attorneys? What would you suggest that people do who don't, who have these concerns?
I would contact your bar association. That's the association of the attorneys of your area, usually on the county level. They all have some type of pro bono service that would help a person that doesn't have, you know, the means to actually retain an attorney. They'll help you on a, you know, case-by-case basis. They'll kind of screen you. And, you know, every year we do handle a couple, you know, pro bono guardianships through the bar associations. And absolutely, that's a great resource.
I didn't know that. That's really wonderful to know about.
Yeah, if you Google Bar Association in your county, usually about
the
county level.
Bar Association. That's great
yep.
to know. May I ask how you got involved in the autism or your interest in the autism community? It's always interesting to know how people ended up where they are.
I do a lot of trust and estate work, which started out as mostly dealing with the elderly. However, I became I got appointed as the trustee for several individuals that you know, suffered, you know, from various things. But I had a few autistic trustees, beneficiaries of some trust that I was in charge of, and you know, I really enjoyed helping them. I then got involved with a couple organizations that kind of do everything, and I'm not in-house counsel to them, but I kind of serve at their pleasure. So I've been active, you know, with the whole community for a little while now, and really, it's one part of my practice I really do enjoy. You know, is being, because oftentimes there's no trustee or there's no guardian. You can be I'm appointed as guardian when the parents die or something happens. Oftentimes, just by the court.
Yeah, is this like in cases where people have left no will or no clear instruction?
That's right. No, you know, no will, or the person that was in the will has predeceased. You know, there's so many things that happen that you just can't plan for. And you know, I'm on a panel that they you know, I get put on these cases from time to time. And so that's basically how I got involved.
That brings up a really good point, because I know that this whole thinking about when we're no longer here is very painful for us as parents, mm-hmm. parents period, but then parents of special needs children even more so. And it's so important because we have very busy days. And so something like putting together a will is something, even though we think we don't have a lot, you still have something. And there still needs to be something put into effect about what's going to happen when you're not here. Who's going to take care of your child, or who's going to have the right to say what's going to happen to your child? And so how far in advance do you think people should be thinking about wills and so forth?
Well, I mean, you need one. If you have a child, you need one. Autistic or not, you need one. Otherwise, you don't get a say. That's it. It's a simple thing to do. It's painless. You know, I would do it. Get it out of the way. You know, don't expect to pay a lot. I would be, I caution people about doing their own wills. Don't do your own will. Have someone do your will. You need, there's certain testamentary formalities that must be complied with. So don't do your own will, but get it done. And then update it every 5 to 10 years. You know, people die, relationships changed. Your best friend that was going to be the guardian, you're no longer friends with, or they've gotten divorced, or whatever it is, you know, update it. Keep, you know, that's what you have to do.
That's a good point. It's just like the conservatorships or the guardianships. Those aren't forever because you have to review every once in a while.
Well, yes. And especially with the guardianships, there's typically an accounting requirement, a reporting requirement on usually like an annual basis. You know, you got to provide a report to a judge and make sure everything's still working and if there's a problem. And, you know, you need oversight. You need lots of different professionals looking at it. And that's what's most of what the guardianship is making sure enough people are looking at the situation that the person doesn't fall into the cracks.
There's a couple more questions here, but I wanted to ask one before I forget about it. And here in the state of California, they advise us also, not necessarily our attorney who helped us, but even the case manager at the regional center, they said, make sure you have a letter of intent, like write up about your child, what they do every day, what they like, what they don't like, and what you intend and what they want as their life. And is that something that you highly recommend as well?
I would, and the reason you do that is because you can't put certain things into a will. You know, you can't direct certain things. They would be violative of, you know, certain testamentary rules. But you can let your executors or your trustees or whoever's going to be in charge after your life know, you know, how it was, what it's supposed to look like. And so, yes, that is very important, especially if there are things that, you know, you want to do, because you can't put in the will that, you know, you're supposed to go to this park on Thursday. You know, you can't have that in the will, but you really want to do a letter of intent.
You mean what he likes to do and what his schedule is and what
exactly
kind of place he wants to live in.
That's right.
All right. Okay. So that's pretty – and that's something also that should be updated and changed because –
yes.
You know, people change. And is it helpful if you have video with that, or do you have to also have a letter along with the video? I mean, I know that it's not really a legal document or anything, but...
It's not. It's not a legal document in terms of the courts, you know, not in a position to enforce it as your, you know, last will and testament. But it's given to the executor, who then is in charge of, you know, marshaling the assets and making sure... things happen. So, yeah, you can do a video. It's just as unenforceable as the letter, but still helpful is what it really is, helpful.
Yeah. Okay, here's Arletta Reidler from Ridgefield. I hope I'm not slaughtering people's names, but with my name, mine gets slaughtered all the time. So here it is. I have a 47-year-old son who lives in a group home.
Mm-hmm.
I've hired a speech-language pathologist to train the staff at the group home on how my son communicates. The staff is not cooperating. And now that they are saying that the training is causing his bad behaviors to escalate, the specialist I've hired is citing faults with the caregivers, and they're blaming her. How can I get them to follow the plans she has written in great detail? I, too, believe the fault is with the staff and staff management.
Well... you know, we need to know, I guess, whether this is these are services being provided by the state or if this is a private facility. That matters greatly. This is a problem where there's two approaches. You've got conflicting approaches. Ultimately, if it's a private facility, you can, and they're just not going to ever get along, you have to make the decision what is more important. If it is a state facility, some service that he's entitled to, it's an entitlement service, you may then have, you'll be able to redress it through some type of grievance process, some type of administrative fair hearing you would likely be able to avail yourself of. In New York, we do have these fair hearings to determine appropriate services. And so that's how you would do it. I can't speak specifically how you would do it in your location.
Yeah, it's a tough situation. And the thing is, too, is that sometimes even when you're doing something that's right, behaviors escalate just because it's new.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
So, it sounds like there needs to be a lot of training on all sides. But it's true that it's hard to, if someone's not going to be or a place is not cooperative, even if you can legally get them to be seen as having to be cooperative, doesn't mean you're going to get people to have the
That's
attitude
right.
to be cooperative. So I wish luck to this person because it's not always an easy situation. So someone else in Portland would like to know, is there a limit to how many guardians you can put in a place or put in place?
That is a state-specific question. Usually... State-specific. I know New York typically, we only like to have two guardians at a given time. Any more than that, it becomes cumbersome to get anything done. Usually the rule of thumb is two guardians at any time. You have three guardians. It's hard to get three people to agree on anything and to consult on every matter. It makes it very difficult. Sometimes you can have a maximum of two with one as a monitor, but usually it's about two. I wouldn't recommend more than two anyway.
Yeah. Do you ever have a situation where you might have one who's in charge of the money and one who's in charge of making educational decisions or medical decisions?
Yes, that is sometimes the case. Someone is more attuned at dealing with their personal and health and medical requirements, and somebody else handles the money. Usually it's within a family that you're going to do that.
Right, I see. Make that decision.
But yes, oftentimes, and that way, again, you have oversight. One is watching the other, and that way we make sure everybody does what they're supposed to do and we achieve the best result.
Okay. That's really good advice. It's all about getting along.
Oh, yes.
So that is all that I have for questions that come in. If anybody has any more questions, send them in now because we're going to be ending soon. If there are no more questions, I'm going to ask Nathan, do you want to repeat for those who are listening and can't see your wonderful information on the slide there?
Sure.
Do you want to give your contact information?
Absolutely. My name again is Nathan DeCorpo. My offices are located at 479 Merrick Road. That's in Lynbrook, New York, 11563. Feel free to send us letters or questions anytime. You can check out my main website. That's at Schlissel, S-C-H-L-I-S-S-E-L, lawfirm.com. We do have a lot of posted, published blog articles. You can search through them, several hundred, in fact, at this point. And you can reach me by email. It's ndecorpo, that's D-E-C-O-R-P-O, .law@gmail.com. And you can contact me, too, at 516-305-2492.
Great. Thank you so much, Nathan, for being here and giving us all that wonderful information.
Well, thank you very much for having me. Do appreciate
it. We really appreciate it.
Yeah. Call me. Contact me if you have any follow-up questions for me, okay?
Thank you so much, Nathan.
Take care.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.